This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
In celebration of the New York Giants 100th season, we have another special for you. And what's better than to relive the history by seeing pieces of the history? Jeffrey Payne, our vintage collector friend, has come with some of his great stuff on the Giants from almost 100 years ago. And Jeff tells us all about it in just a moment.
Take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
History Network. Let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your port of positive football history, and welcome to another edition of a collector's corner of sorts. We have our friend Jeffrey Payne with us from the vintage football community, and Jeff has some great things to share with us for our celebration of the New York Giants 100th season coming up in 2024. And Jeff, welcome back to the Pigpen.
It's great to be here, Darren. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Jeff, you shared an email with me. You knew we were celebrating a lot of Giants items and been a kind of a popular event for us. And you really have some neat things in your collection that really fall right in with what we've been talking about here the last 13, 14 episodes on our NYG 100 series.
Yeah, that's totally cool. Yeah, we can start as early as you want to go. You tell me where you want to begin.
Well, you take us back as far as you can and let's go. Let's go. We'll go chronologically. How's that sound?
That sounds cool. Yeah, I don't know how much you've talked about it already, but obviously the New York Giants 1925 was actually not the first professional team in New York City, and they weren't even the first NFL team in New York City, which a lot of people don't know. There was an NFL team that was earlier than them. They actually were formed before the NFL in 1919. They went by the name of the New York Brickley Giants for two reasons. One is the New York baseball Giants funded the team, and Charles Brickley, who was a two-time All-American at Harvard in the mid-teens, very well known in the Northeast, he was kind of the person who put it all together. And back then, of course, it was very common for teams to put the name of their star in their name, like Nevers, was often mentioned for the Duluth Eskimos, and Thorpe's name worked its way in a few times in some of the teams. So it wasn't uncommon for, teams to try to use their star's name to, attract.
Red Grange's Yankees. And
exactly. Yeah. And so, they called themselves the New York Brickley Giants. And actually in 1919, they ended up not playing any games because, at the time, that was back when there were the blue laws where you couldn't play and do things on Sunday. Well, in 1919, New York City passed a law that you were allowed to play baseball on Sundays. So the New York baseball Giants were like, oh, that's cool. Well, maybe we should create a football team and play football on Sundays after the baseball season ends. And that's how they kind of hooked up with Charles Brickley. But unfortunately, New York City was like, no. We just meant baseball. We didn't mean football. And they apparently got their whole team organized and structured and everything. And they were just about to play their first game. And they found out they weren't allowed to play on Sundays. And that just they just said, forget it. We're disbanding the team, if that's the case. Because we want to play on Sunday when nobody's working. So, that transpired. And then they went dormant for a couple of years. And then in 1921, popped back up. It wasn't the New York baseball Giants this time. It was what was his name? Billy Gibson. Billy Gibson. He was a boxing promoter in New York City. And he heard about the NFL. He thought, hey, there ought to be a team in New York City. And he and Charles Brickley again got together, and Billy Gibson funded it, and Brickley was the coach and the you know, player coach, and I think he owned part of it too. And they, you know, entered the NFL that season. They have the distinction of being the team that played the second least games in NFL history. They only played two NFL games. They lost them both. And then they folded, or they dropped out of the league. They were still around as an independent team for a while.
Real quick, do you know the name of the team that played the least amount?
Oh, sure. Tonawanda.
Yeah, okay. Lumberjacks or the
Lumberjacks
Kardecs,
or Kardecs or whoever they went for. Yeah, they played one game and dropped out, and the Brooklyn Giants played two. Yeah, I actually have a postcard of one of the Tonawanda players.
Oh, really?
I've been outgunned several times when they've come up on eBay. You know, there's probably, I don't know, a handful of people in the world that when they see those things, they know what they are. But there's always one other person that knows it too and always seems to outgun me. But I finally got my hands on one.
I know two or three Buffalo, New York, Western New York collectors are probably people you're bidding against.
Yes. Yeah. I know where many of them live, which is fine. You know, I just happened to finally get one. So I was pretty happy about that because that's a cool story too.
Right. You know, yeah. We'll have to talk about that sometime too.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. Yeah. I do have a couple of nice images of Charles Brickley, if you want me to.
Yeah, go ahead. You have the share screen capability. Please do.
Cool. Let me do that. Let me see the easiest way to do that. I think I'll just share screen and just pop them up. Probably easiest here. All right. Should be coming up for you. Can you see it?
My screen? Hold on a second. Yep, there we go.
Yeah, so here's Charles Brickley. When he played for the Massillon Tigers in Ohio. So after Harvard, he played for Massillon for a few years. And this is just a great shot of an early professional player who was very well known. This shows him obviously kicking, or maybe, you know, looks like maybe even a drop kick because he's not lifting his leg very high. But 1917 Massillon Tigers Charles Brickley in action, right?
Hey, you can tell he's a little older in these days.
Well, yeah, when you see him later, he gained some weight. I was gonna like, I had to like look at it. I was like, is this even the same dude? Like, he looks like he bounced up and down too. Maybe lost his baby fat and he got a little thinner. And then later on, he put some more weight on here.
Some of the diets that Oprah was, how she was gaining weight and losing weight all the time. You know,
there you go. Now this, you'll notice he's a little bit chunkier in this picture. This is from his high school or his college days. So this is when he was at Harvard.
Oh yeah.
He looks bigger here to me. His face is thin, but he looks
a little thicker maybe in the midsection. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's his coach, Percy Houghton, who's a Hall of Fame coach and coached at Harvard for many years. So this is,
Photo.
Mid-teams photo of him. And then I do have one actually from 1919 when he was trying to get the Giants off the ground. Unfortunately, since they didn't play, it's not of him with the Giants, but instead it's with him showing Fordham University players how to kick. You'll notice that almost all of Brickley's photos are him kicking the ball. You know, that was, you know, obviously back then kicking was so important in the game of football, you know, particularly before passing was even allowed. But even in these days, passing was not, you know, done frequently. It was more desperation and the rules didn't really support it. So, you know, teams were punting very frequently. You needed a good kicker. You needed somebody who could pin them down and make them go the distance because that was almost impossible to do. And so, you know, players like Brickley, you know, Thorpe was another one who were known for their kicking prowess. They also were both great drop kickers. You needed that kicker, right? In fact, a story about the 1921 team, you know, one of the two NFL teams that the Brickley Giants did play was Thorpe's Cleveland team. Sometimes they went by the Indians, sometimes they went by the Tigers. Sometimes they went by the Thorpes, I swear. You know, they used all sorts of names.
Was it the Oorang team or was it Cleveland?
Was 22 and 23. This was Cleveland Tigers / Indians / whatever. They seemed to change their name every so often. But they played one of the only two NFL games that the Brickley Giants played, and they played the Polo Grounds. And the reason people know this game is because Thorpe and Brickley put on a kicking exhibition. And there's actually a photo out there. I don't own it. I know there, if you Google it, it is out there. You'll see it because it's posted a few places. It shows both of them kind of getting ready to punt. It was probably staged, but they put on a kicking exhibition. And apparently there's some controversy about who won that. Some accounts say Brickley kicked, they were drop kicking and kicking field goals. And some say Brickley kicked the farthest one. And somebody else said, no, on this last try, Thorpe surpassed him and won it. You know, of course, back then it was anything to get a fan in the stadiums, and you know, they often did kicking exhibitions and just any kind of entertainment imaginable, right? Like, you know, you mentioned the Oorang Indians; they always used to bring their dogs out from the kennel and have them do tricks and do other things. I even heard they like used to tree a bear. If there was a tree around, they'd get a bear out there, and it sounded kind of crazy to me, but that's the kind of stuff they were doing back then for entertainment.
They had to do something to compete against the college game. So pulling out all the stops was one way to do it. So yeah, very interesting. Yep. Very cool pictures.
Yep.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, they didn't make it, but as I'm sure you know, and people probably heard then, of course, in 25, the actual New York Giants came along that are not affiliated at all with the Brickley Giants. So their histories aren't aligned.
But there's a little bit of history though involved, because we've learned that, you know, from Alan March, who's the great grandson of Dr.
Yep.
Harry March, that and it's also recorded in Dr. March's writings, you know, his famous book on early football history, that Dr. March and Tim Mara, or before they approached Tim Mara, Joe Carr and March went to Billy Gibson to try to get him to fund the New York team. And he didn't want it. He had a bad taste in his mouth, I guess, from the previous experience, and stayed with boxing. And Mara took the chance on it. So,
Cool. And I feel kind of bad for Billy Gibson, because the reason he took the team in 21 was because the NFL staged an exhibition game in late 2020 or 1920. Sorry, wrong century. In 1920. Between, I think it was the Canton Bulldogs and, oh, it was the Buffalo All-Americans. And so they were two good teams in the league, and they had an exhibition game in New York City, and they had 20,000 people show up. So, you know, Joe Carr's like, wow, you know, New York City, biggest city in America, right? We need a team here. And he, you know, Billy Gibson's like, wow, boy, people really like football. I'm all in, and, you know, paid the money and then sunk like a rock. So, you know, I think the promise was there, right? I mean, that game showed that if you had the right teams or right audience or right situation, you know, people would show up in New York. But I think Billy Gibson was like, nah, you got me once on this. You know, I'm not doing it again. But to your point, of course, he introduced Joe Carr to Tim Mara. And, you know, as I understand it, you know, Dr. March's grandson, right? Grandson, is that what?
Great grandson, yeah. I believe.
Great grandson would know better than I do, certainly. But my understanding was Mara said, I don't know anything about football at all. Like, this sounds cool. I'm a sportsman. And he, you know, reached out to find out who could help him put together a team and who knew something about football to help him out. And he, you know, pulled in Dr. March, and who really orchestrated everything and got the players and did all the heavy lifting. Cause Mara's like, I don't know anything about the sport, you know,
I think the rest of his quote was, cause there was a $500 entrance fee the car was charging to get in. He said, God, anything's worth a bet on $500, you know, or something to that effect. So, that had to be a good chunk of change back in, you know, 1920s.
$500, I read it was, it equates to like, I just read it, somewhere between 10 and 20,000 maybe in today's dollars. So it wasn't a huge amount of money, but still, you know, hey, you know, it's not something usually lying around. You're just like, you know, thrown to the wind. But Mara did it. And here we are, right? 100 years later. And, you know,
yeah. That
I'm
added
sure.
quite a bit to football, that's for sure.
Yeah, no, the Giants are obviously an iconic franchise. It's so cool that we're starting to see 100-year anniversaries for these teams now, right?
Amazing.
Like, we got some coming up in the early 30s as well, right?
Right, yeah.
Those are all
Most
coming up.
definitely.
And of course, this year is also the Pottsville Maroons, one of my loves, their 100th year anniversary of their start in the and almost end in the NFL.
In the
So,
NFL, right?
yeah,
Yeah,
so it's
very,
cool
very cool.
to see teams that are that old.
Yeah, who'd have thought?
Yeah, I know, right? And I love the story about the Grange game. Of course, that's pretty well published and legendary of, Grange coming into New York City and, playing against the Giants. And, the numbers I saw, and y'all might have covered it, was I think Mara was something like $40,000 in the hole at the end of that first season. And they'd had a good year. I think they lost their first three games, NFL games, and then they won like seven in a row. I mean, they had a pretty stinking good year for their first year in the league, but they couldn't draw enough to break even. And what I heard was Mara was really on the fence about how long am I going to do this? If it's going to be a, 40,000 year, $40,000 investment every year, I can't do that very, very long, and everybody says that more or less Grange and the Bears coming into New York playing that infamous game that drew what, close to 70,000 fans, they estimate.
Yeah, there's between 70 and 74,000. There's been
Yeah,
different
it's
reports, and the
incredible.
newspapers
They
weren't
stopped
super
counting, I
accurate.
think.
Yeah,
They just
they
like
ran out
to
of
be like,
fingers and
woohoo.
toes.
Yeah, that kind of saved the year, right? Saved the franchise, maybe. It's
Yeah, and I
possible that
probably
Mara would have
saved
given up.
football in New York, for
Yeah, they would have had to gone back to Billy Gibson again and see what he can rustle up next, right?
Yeah,
I
exactly.
do have a couple of cool things from some of the players on that first team. Now, I don't have anything that shows Thorpe on that team because he did play for them early on in the season. I think that was Mara's first attempt at, hey, I'm gonna bring in a name, hopefully a draw. And yeah, I don't remember what he was paying Thorpe, but I'm sure it wasn't cheap because Thorpe didn't play for cheap. Didn't matter how old he was, he wasn't playing for cheap. But he didn't play very much. He was just too old, just too injured, too broken down. And I don't remember how many games he was involved, but Mara cut him loose at some point and they just agreed to part ways because he wasn't helping the team and they were losing so much money that, it just didn't make sense for him to stay engaged. Ironically, I have a photo of Dutch Hendrian, who was another player on the team, old school pro. I don't have it with me right now, but it's really skinny, tall and skinny. And I always
Okay.
wonder why it was cut like that. Well, it's actually a picture that has Thorpe in it too. It's Hendrian and Thorpe and like one or two other dudes in a row on the field. Somebody cut it up, sold it off. I'm sure they sold the Thorpe out from under it. So I can say I have part of a photo of Thorpe, but it doesn't show photo of Thorpe in it. You got to like imagine he's next to him, when you look at it. If
Just
it
have a like his
just
hand or
shows.
something.
Exactly. It just shows Dutch Hendry. But I've seen the full photo. And I'm like, man, I wish I had that full photo because that's pretty cool.
Yeah,
But
it
two
would be.
players I'm sure you all have talked about, which I really admire, and they were definitely stars of that team, were Hinkie Haynes and Jack McBride. Of course, you and
Absolutely.
I being Pennsylvania boys, we love the fact both those boys grew up in Pennsylvania, so,
Yeah.
Hinkie Haynes was from, I think, Red Lion. That's where he grew
Yeah,
up.
I think so.
I think that's it. I actually wrestled a kid from Red Lion in college. Never wrestled anybody from there in high school, but I wrestled him in college. I think he went to Lock Haven or Bloomsburg or somewhere. So I knew Red Lion. They had good wrestling programs. And Jack McBride was from closer to Philly, down by Conshohocken, which is like between like Valley Forge and Philly-ish, sort of. So they were both Pennsylvania boys, which go
Yeah.
PA, right? Go
Yeah.
PA.
Surprised
And of
the
course,
Anthracite League didn't like snatch him up, because they were
I
going
know,
strong.
right? Yeah. Well, I think Haynes played for one of the semi-pro teams earlier in the 20s. I'm going to say a Philly team, maybe like the Quakers. There was an independent team in Philly that was pretty big at that time.
They had like Union Club of Phoenixville,
something like that. Yeah,
Frankfurt
or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
He played there, but I don't think either of them played in the Anthracite League. Of course, you know, I love trivia, right? Like what team played the, you know, fewest NFL games. Of course, you know, Hinkie Haynes claimed to fame as, I believe he's the only player that won a World Series and an NFL championship.
That's right.
Of course, Deion Sanders made it to the World Series, and he won several NFL championships, you know, Super Bowls. He didn't win the World Series, though. Wasn't with the Braves when they won, so he doesn't qualify. So, yeah, Hinkie Haynes is the only one. Great, great trivia question for you all, football guys. And, you know, there's not a lot of Hinkie Haynes stuff out there. I mean, I've seen some photos and stuff like that. I have one thing from Hinkie Haynes, which is kind of cool. Let me share my screen again real quick, and I'll bring it up. And it's a baseball item, actually. It's Colt's Mother's Bread pin, Hinkie Haynes, with the Yankees in 23. He only played 1 year in the major league, so he was fortunate enough to play with the Yanks and win the World Series.
What does the F stand for, like fielder?
No. Well, he was a center fielder, but his first name is Frank or Fred.
Okay.
I don't know if that's the position or his first initial. I don't know, because he was a center fielder. So I'm like, okay, does that mean they were designating he was a fielder, or is that designated his first name was whatever it is? Sorry, with an F. I know that.
Yeah, that probably is the same Hinkie color as his last name. It's probably his first initial. Yeah, that's good.
It could be. Yeah, I'd have to find another. Cool. They did a bunch of Mother's Bread did a bunch of pins that year. Of players. So, yeah. So, you know, one of the things I collect is kind of a sub collection. You and I may have talked about it is I call it footballers in other sports. Mm-hmm. And I have this huge checklist of every player that I've ever been able to find that played professional football all the way back to the 1800s, but also has something from another sport. A lot of it's baseball, right? You know, you've got the, you know, Patty Driscoll's and the Ernie Nevers and those guys who all played baseball, and they've got various cards, you know, but, you know, occasionally you find some kind of cool items like this as well. It's the only Hinkie Haynes item that I've seen.
How about one of my favorites, Jack Hayden, who would have been turn of the century, you know, played for the Franklin team I wrote about, and I think he played for Connie Mack in the Philadelphia Athletics in baseball. Yeah.
So that's my Hinkie Haynes. I have a couple of Jack McBride. He's the other guy. Of course, he didn't stay in state. Hinkie Haynes went to Penn State, by the way. So he's a Nittany Lion. Hashtag we are. but he was a you know, baseball and football player at Penn State. Did really well in that. But McBride left the state. He left the Philly area, went to Syracuse, and had a good career up there in Syracuse before he drifted back, you know, over to New York. I have a couple of things from him that I like.
This was like, and Haynes and McBride in those first few Giants teams, that was their rushing special. That was their backfield mates too.
Yep. They were backfield mates. And also, you know, back in that day, they both threw a lot of passes too. So you'll see them designated as, you know, quarterback / halfback or something, mm-hmm. both of them. In fact, I think Hinkie Haynes was designated as the QB the year they won the NFL championship in 27. So he was considered their quarterback, but they both threw the ball. This is the back of a Giants program. And I always liked this image of Jack McBride. He just looks so tough there. I mean, you can tell he was a brawler and a bruiser. I always thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, he looks like a hard ass. Somebody you don't want to go outside with at the bar at night.
Yeah, you know? he might have spent some time downtown Philly getting into some fist fights when he was young and spry. And then he has a matchbook as well from 33, which I think is cool.
That's a Syracuse uniform he has on?
You know, I mean, it's 33, but who knows when that photo was taken.
The first thing, if I'm reading upside down, product of Syracuse
product
University.
Of Syracuse. Doesn't say what the uniform is. It's kind of a funky uniform. It does have a lot of orange in it. So, of course, the Giants had some, you know, orange too, right, for a while? Yeah, I think they might have.
Yeah, they could have.
Yep, so that's his matchbook, which I think was cool.
Yeah, if I'm reading right, they're advertising, you know, size, what, 5'11", 185 pounds. You know, today that would be the water boy, I think.
I know, right? Yeah, maybe. Ball boy. And then my big piece from 25 is the, you know, the program from the game. So I've had a couple of these, actually. They're not as hard to find as you might imagine, just because there were 70,000 of them. Well, who knows how many people bought the program, but obviously there were a lot of these programs purchased at that game. So, you know, I am working on a run of all of the barnstorming programs from the Red Grange barnstorming tour, you know, that started, you know, right after he graduated. Well, right after he finished his last college game up through early 26.
And that's a lot of games. We had you know, Chris Willis of NFL Films wrote a good, nice book on. We had him on and have his book and, you know, great coverage of all those different stops in the Floridas and out west and everywhere else. It was pretty cool. Yeah, that would be quite a bucket list of items.
Yeah, no, that'd be a fun talk too, is to talk that through that thing. I have quite a few things from that. I don't have a massive amount of programs. I probably have 5 or 6 of them. And I think there was like 18 or 20 barnstorming games. And I've missed on 2 as well. You know, a longtime collector friend, you know, I remember him telling a story about how he missed on something he really wanted. And he said, oh, well, you know, I'll get it next time it rolls around. And then he said it took 12 years before he saw it again. And his lesson was, if it's something that really, really fits your collection, you really, really want, and you know it's really, really rare, you better freaking buy it.
Yeah, you got to buy it when it's available.
You may never see it again. And I violated that rule twice, and I am still kicking myself because I have never seen either of those programs again. This one you will see. I've had 2 copies of this program. I traded one a few years ago for some other very early NFL programs, but just a great image of Grange on the front, you know.
Hey, Jeff, just curious, so going to your collector side, when you have paper products, you know, that were not meant to survive and be 100 years old like they are, how do you care for those or display them? Or, you know, are they like locked in way in darkness, or do you have them like matted and framed? How do you display that?
Yeah, I don't have any of my programs matted and displayed. I have some big cabinet photos matted and displayed. They're all behind, you know, ultra UV glass. I keep my programs and my other stuff for the most part in binders in the dark. Never see the light of day other than if I pull it out and look at it. But yeah, in you know, acid-free, you know, holders and binder pages, you know, you do need to be careful. Cause I mean, right. 100 years old, this thing is 100 years old,
right.
You know, and you know, you can see it's gone through the war. Looks like somebody crumpled it up and stuck it, wadded it in their coat
pocket.
Spilled
a cup of coffee on it on the corner.
I know, right? Yeah. Well, it's funny. A lot of those old programs you will see, and they will just have a crease right straight down the middle. Cause of course, back then everybody dressed up to go out. And you can just envision somebody getting a program at the end of the game, fold it in half, stick it in their coat inside pocket, right? I do that with stuff all the time if I have a suit coat on. And it's just, I think it's kind of cool, right? You're like, oh, I know what happened to this program. I know exactly what this person did. Watch the game and then folded it in half and stuck it in their coat pocket. And here it is today. This one didn't do that, but it looks like they, I don't know, held it over their head to stop the rain, or I don't know what they did with this thing, but it got beat up a little bit.
Yeah, we'll have to see what the weather report was on December 6, 1925 in New York.
Oh, well, you know, I don't know if you heard the story about that, but my understanding was that of course, this was early December. So early December in New York, you could get anything, right? I mean, that's like playing in Chicago in December. And my understanding from what I read is that the weather coming up to the game was not very good. I don't know that they had a lot of snow, but I know it was cold and they had some precipitation. They had some rain. And what I've heard is that Mara was just nervous as all heck. I mean, he was betting a lot on this game. Of course, he went out there to the Midwest to try to convince Grange to play for the Giants. That didn't work out. It's too late. But kudos to him. He immediately pivoted around and he said, well, next best thing is get him to come to New York for a game. And he got that commitment. And now it's all dependent on the weather, right? And what I heard is it up until the day before, it was not good weather. And sometime that night, the night before the game, skies cleared up, things got nicer out. Still cold, obviously, in New York, but nice day, at least partly sunny. And he woke up and he was just like, thank you, God. I need this. And I read that the Giants made like $140,000 off that game, something like that. Now, I don't know if that was the grand total and then they split it, with Grange and the Bears, or that was their take. But regardless, it more than pulled them out of the hole and, gave them a cushion that they could use going forward, which, is
Right.
pretty
Sign
cool.
in some of these players that helped them win a championship, but you're coming up.
Well, another trivia, another early trivia is at one point, Tim Mara owned at the same time three NFL franchises.
Really? Okay, I know about one
Because,
other one other than the Giants, but
yes, he, my understanding is, obviously he made the decision to buy the Detroit team because he wanted Benny Friedman. That
Right.
was the only way he could get them was they were flailing, but they belonged to Detroit. He was worried somebody else was going to buy him. I think he bought it for like 10 grand. So he bought the Detroit team and took their players. And so now he had two. And I don't remember what he did with that one. I don't remember if he turned it back in the league eventually, but he had two. And then the other one was, my understanding is because of his arrangement with Grange and CeCe Pyle, when he allowed them to come into the NFL with the other New York team, the Yankees, if I'm remembering that right, that was the third one that he ended up with when CeCe Pyle decided he didn't want to carry forward with the NFL version of that team after a few years. And he ended up with that one too. And I believe that became the Staten Island Stapletons. Like he sold that to somebody else to form the Stapletons because he still owned,
Oh,
of course,
okay.
the rights in New York. And he was only going to sell it to somebody that, he kind of felt like he controlled or they weren't, encroaching in the territory. But he actually, I read he had three NFL franchises at the same
I
time.
was just taking a wild guess. I was thinking like maybe the Horsemen, the AFL Horsemen team, because I know they merged with somebody, and I couldn't remember if that was it. But so he had the New York
I think,
Rangers, CeCe Pyle Yankees in their NFL year. Okay,
I
after that.
believe that is, yeah. So he
Okay.
owned three at once, which is kind of freaking
Wow.
crazy
Yeah.
if you think about
Yeah,
it.
it
From not knowing anything about football to owning
is.
basically three franchises, two of them defunct. Obviously, they weren't playing
Yeah,
ball,
but
but he did
how many
own the
people can say that, because even like Burt Bell
zero.
is only part of two, he was ownership of two different franchises. I can't think of anybody else that
Well,
unless you.
especially at the same time, right? You could think of like, Ollie Hosgrove, if that's how you pronounce his name, who owned the Eskimos and then negotiated with the
The
NFL,
Vikings.
a smart man, to
Yeah.
have the right to be part owner in a future team in the area. And man, that was a pretty cool move on his part. I can't think of many that
Unless you
owned.
count like Ursay trading the with the Rams Colts thing at the with and the other party on that. I forget their name, but yeah, very cool.
The other thing I thought you might like is, and you may have had somebody else show one of these, but these were season passes. They call them silver passes that
Oh,
the New York Giants sold
I've
for
never
their
seen that
games.
before. That's cool.
Well, I think they stole it from some of the New York baseball teams because I've seen baseball ones. They're obviously not shaped like this, but they're baseball ones from the mid-20s too from New York. And I can't remember if they were Yankees or Giants, but same idea, right? A silver pass, with the team on the front. And then on the back, which I think is really cool, is, you know, the name of the person.
Wow.
And the number of the pass. And this is for the 1926 season. Now, wow. I've made it a little hobby. Every time one of these comes up, I go on newspapers.com to see if I can figure out who the heck this person was, right? I did track down Mr. Trumbull. As you would imagine, if you were buying a season pass, you probably had some cash in 26. So it wasn't actually that hard to find the ones that I've seen, because they tend to be people who are at least somewhat well-known or affiliated with sports in the New York area. Mr. Trumbull was a newspaper columnist for one of the papers. I've read some of his articles from back in 25, 26. It's clearly him, which is kind of cool. You know, I think he was in Brooklyn. Is that where he was at? Yeah, I think it was Brooklyn. I've seen one for John McGraw, you know, manager for the, okay, the New York, you know, baseball,
yeah,
team.
The baseball Giants,
back,
yeah.
Back in the day, I've seen one for him. So he was clearly a season ticket holder. And I've seen one for a judge. So I tracked him down from some of the court cases, his name. Yeah, so it's just a little kind of cool.
Now, how large is this actually? Is this like the size of a coin or, you know?
Yeah, I have it blown up here so you can see. I'd say it's about, it's hard to tell on the screen, but yeah. Like, you know how you put those coins in a machine and stretch them out? It's mm-hmm. not that small. They're bigger than that. But, you know, they're probably two inches long, 1 inch high, maybe a little bigger than that. Nice size.
And they're like pure silver? Or is it just silver in color?
I do not know what they're – well, there's a mark down there. I don't know. They call them silver passes. I do not know if they're actual silver or not.
That'd be a pretty expensive token to be carrying to a football game. Say, okay, I'm here for my seat.
Right?
I want the gate.
Well, pretty expensive tickets to be, producing for your fans too. You know, these are hard to get, and they're hard to get because when they do show up, they go for some cash. I mean, probably Giants fans really like these, and they do not show up. I've only seen, like I said, a handful of them through the years, and they're hard to get. I took 3 or 4 runs at them before I finally was able to get one. I just think they're cool.
That's really unique. I've never seen or heard of those before. That is neat.
Yep.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. So I think that's my stuff from the Giants, early Giants, memorabilia wise. I have later stuff, some Friedman things and other things, of course, into the 30s. But in terms of the first couple of years of the Giants,
that's the stuff
I've been able to track down.
Yeah, those are, I mean, that's great. I mean, we've talked about some of these folks, but you shared some different stories about them. Some, you know, we saw some different images of them from your collection, learned some new things like the silver, the pass that you had. And that's all great stuff. And the matchbook, I've never seen that before. That's some really neat stuff that they used to make.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, I love trying to find images of pro players, you know, from the early days, because there weren't a lot of cards back then. You know, there weren't many card sets. So, you know, there's no Tops, there's no Bowman, there's none of that stuff out there. So you got to kind of really dig to find things, whether it's photos or, you know, matchbooks or pins or backs of programs, fronts of programs. There's just not that many images for a lot of these players, you know,
from that era. It seems like advertisers love to use their images, though, you know, like you had the Mother's Bread and what was the matchbook, probably a cigarette company or something. I'm guessing
Diamond matchbooks. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Real cool.
Yeah. And I do have some, you know, when Grange came to New York City, I know the story is, you know, one of the ways that Mara enticed him and the Bears and whatnot to come play that game was, you know, he's like, hey, you know, New York City, advertising capital of the world, you can sign endorsement deals there. And my understanding is Grange and Pyle either came a day earlier or stayed a day later and just basically set up in the hotel and were like, just bring it, whatever you want Grange to endorse, you come and pitch it and we'll take the the best deals. And apparently they signed up a lot of endorsement deals while they were in New York City.
Yeah,
a
but he had like some
Meatloaf, I heard.
Candy bars, I think crazy. I've seen
of
before.
Of course, Shotwell. Yeah, the Shotwell candy bars, which the movie came out of that. The movie, came out of that as well, associated with the Shotwells. I think that was actually a Kennedy production, right? Wasn't it Joe Kennedy? I think Joe Kennedy produced
really?
The movie
oh.
1 Minute to Play, which was the Grange movie, and Shotwell was the sponsor for that movie because, then they produced those great card sets of Grange, the ad backs and the blank backs from the movie. So I think, I don't remember what I heard Grange ended up with endorsement deal wise out of that New York City trip, but it was a lot. He raked it up, including the Meatloaf story. I love the Meatloaf. I've never seen anything with Grange's picture on a Meatloaf before. So I kind of wonder how that all went down, but apparently that was one of the endorsement deals that he signed.
What was it, like a tin in the shape of his head? Or
I don't know. I've never
you
seen
your meatloaf
I've never
in
seen
it?
A piece.
You want your meatloaf to look like a football player. Here we go.
Yeah, I mean, the Shotwell wrappers are out there. The Shotwell cards are out there. There's movie placards. I have a big kind of broadside advertisement for that movie. Hanging up in my basement that I picked up somewhere. So, a lot of those endorsement deals, there's stuff out there to grab. And I love grabbing, advertisement type stuff with football on it, but I've never seen the Meatloaf. I don't know what happened with that one,
Yeah. Probably not any of them left. I've probably got eaten or thrown away by now.
Yeah, I know. Right. You're going to keep a Meatloaf can.
Yeah, I don't want to smell 100-year-old Meatloaf.
I know. I have a couple of the Shotwell, boxes that the candy bars came in as well.
Yeah,
those are floating around out there. You'll see them.
They gotta be rare.
They're pretty rare, but they once in a while one will pop up eBay or at auction or whatever, more so than the wrappers do. The wrappers you never see. They're really hard to find, and there's different varieties. There's I think it's four or five different versions of the wrapper that are out there. I think I have three or four of them. Never found them all. They're impossible to find. I'm always on the prowl. One came up, actually. I think it was on eBay sometime in the last couple of months, but it was one I already had. So,
I mean, who would have thought when some kid's eating a candy bar and, tossing it away that someday somebody would want that and have it as a piece of the collection and pay big money for it? That's, something is one man's treasure is another man's trash, or however it goes.
One cool thing that came out of that was there's always been a debate about, which card is Red Grange's earliest card. Is it the strip card that was produced? Is it the Shotwell sets that was produced? Is it the Star Player candy? Is it the Spalding/Sports Company America? All those were produced in the 20s at some point, obviously mid to late 20s. But nobody knows for sure when those were actually produced. And for a long time, it was felt like the Star Player candy, which one of the grading companies has is 1925. One of them has is 1928. It could be a range too, right? Nobody knows, because the problem is the card says, he's with Illinois on the card. So everybody's like, well, it can't be after 25. But it wasn't uncommon, of course, back then for the makers of cards to put their college designations on players' cards, because college was just so much more popular than the pros were. And so I don't know if that necessarily means that card's from 1925. I know that some of the other players in the shot or in the Star Player candy set, a couple of the cards designate the player as captain, and that person wasn't a captain until 1928 for their team in college. So they were at least produced until 1928. And so, one of the grading companies has it as 25 because of the Grange. Somebody else has it 28 because some of the cards couldn't have been produced before then. Who knows when, but there's always been this debate about when these cards were produced. But one interesting thing is, so a lot of people say, well, the Star Player candy, because of the 28 cards that are in there, people tend to think maybe it was a little later, and they just put Grange as Illinois because he was so well known for that. But then you have the, well, was it the, when did the Shotwell candy come out? Did it come out before the movie was produced? Because the movie came out in, I think it was the fall of 26. It was filmed during the summer of 26. And if you heard that story, like, they needed people in the stands, but it had to be cold. So they paid people. No, they didn't even pay them. CC Pyle, I think, came up with the idea of, they told people they could come in and watch an exhibition of football if you wear a winter coat during the game. And it was in like LA in the summer. And all these people showed up for free football, and they scrimmaged as part of this movie production. And they got all these people to come for free and wear coats like it was cold out.
In LA.
It's really a great idea, right? So a lot of people are like, well, when did this come out? And you know, could the Shotwells be the earliest? But long story short, one of the wrappers I bought was taken. It was removed from a scrapbook. And on the back of the wrapper, still attached to the wrapper from the back side of the scrapbook, was a piece of a box score from a baseball game. All right. And I was like, okay, I'm going to figure out when this game was played. Is this a 1925 game? Is this a 1926 game? What month? And then I'll be able to know at least, right, when was this candy bar purchased, at least?
Mm-hmm.
And I did track it down through a lot of heavy lifting. It's actually it was a World Series game in 26. So it was played in October of 26. So I at least know the candy bars, at least were being produced during that time frame, around October of 26, which was right around when the movie came out. So they probably coincided, the release.
And
of
it
the candy
coincided
bars
with the AFL Yankees, Red Green Yankees.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Original AFL.
Yep.
That season.
Yeah, that was kind of cool. So I kind of know when those were produced. Subsequently learned that you can tell based on some nuances of the strip cards that were produced, which year they were produced. And the Grange one was produced in 1925. So I kind of lean toward the Grange strip card, black and white strip card that's out there that you see occasionally, as being probably his oldest card, but nobody's certain on that.
Hey,
you know?
That's the fun part of collecting, and
right?
Like in history, when you have those controversies and there's not really any answer mm-hmm. that's definitive, that it makes for great debate and stories and great listening
exactly.
for people like myself and the listener. So
yep.
That's cool stuff. It probably drives you crazy, but we love it.
it's all good. It's not life or death, right? I always say it's just collecting. It's nothing to get worked up about, You have your opinion. I have mine. You have your facts. I have mine. We agree to disagree. Whatever. It's just a hobby. It's just fun.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe with that thought, let's segue in. You have run a forum that has some of the best football minds and historians of our day, because most of them are collectors and just like yourself, know a lot about the pieces they collect. So, when you're throwing down some cash on some things, you want to have some back history on it. So why don't you share with folks, maybe they'd be interested in joining, or, looking at some of the stuff too, that's being shared on our collectors forum.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Thanks, Darren. Yeah. So I run Vintage Football Community. It's a football only community of, I always say, collectors, hobbyists, and researchers, because we have all sorts. You mentioned Chris Willis earlier, who's written a bunch of books. I love all his books on football. And he's a member. He does some collecting, but he's more known for his research and his books and whatever. And if you're going to really understand some of these items and their context, you need people who really know football. Mm-hmm. Timothy Brown, who obviously, is another person that sticks out to me as being somebody who just drills into subjects and knows so much about so many things, that having people like that around, people on our group always say, not a week goes by that you don't see something in the hobby you've never seen before. And it is so true. It's true for me. Every week I'm like, wow, I've never seen that before. I cannot believe that exists. And, you know, it's great because people will post something and say, hey, I don't know what this is, right? We have that one, we have one thread that's the unsolved, we call it Unsolved Mysteries. That,
and Tim has commented multiple times. That's his favorite thing. He loves it when those come up and he gets digging. He loves that.
Yeah. And there's lots of people that do a lot of digging, right? I mean, they'll see something and they'll be like, I think I know where to look for this. And within a couple of days, often, not always, like some stuff you just can't find, but people will dig in and find stuff and pop up context for it. You know what, like I was just doing some research on early black players, pro players, and it reminded me that I had this photo of a, you know, an all black team, and it had a banner, but it was really hard to read it. And I could not figure out what this team was. And finally I gave up and I posted it to, you know, VFC, in that, you know, in that channel. And within a day or two, somebody had it, right? They're like, oh, here's what it is. And what struck me was they mentioned in the article I was reading that the first game between two black teams, college teams, historically black universities, was played between Biddle and Livingston University. Mm-hmm. I think they were in North Carolina or somewhere in the South. And this is a photo, not as old as that game, of Biddle. They had changed their name. So on the pennant that was really hard to read, it had the new name of their college. But the ball had LC for Livingston College. So they clearly had taken this after they'd beaten their arch rival, who they played the first game between historically black colleges. You know, here's a picture, you know, I think it was from the teens. So it was, you know, 15 or so years after the first time they played, but you know, I never would have known what that was if it wasn't for VSC. Right. And we just, you know, it's also a place that collectors can share and talk about stuff and enjoy each other. People that appreciate your stuff, right? You know, I don't know about you, but most people I know, they don't appreciate any of this stuff.
No, yeah, right.
You know, they glaze over. You start talking about it, they start glazing over.
You have to get in a group of football nerds like the VFC is. That's our safe place that we can all enjoy each other's company and collections and the history. So, great forum, great place. And
always looking for new members. It's free. You know, just drop me a line and send it through Darren. If anybody's interested, we're always looking for more people. The more the merrier, you know, the more contacts, the more people showing different things. It's just a great place to kind of enjoy the hobby. So, yeah. And we always do something. Anyone's going to the National this year, you know, which is Mecca for me. I went when it came to Baltimore in like right around 2011, 2012, whenever it was in Baltimore. That was my first National. I was just getting back into the hobby and it was local. So I was like, I'll run up and I'll check this thing out I've heard about. And I just fell in love with it. I've been there every year since, other than obviously COVID year when they didn't have it. And I've already said I'm going to go there until they can't wheel me there anymore. I just love it. And it's not even the content there. I mean, you see so much great stuff, but it's just catching up with people and seeing so many people and talking about so much stuff. And, you know, it's almost like a reunion at this point. And anybody's going to Cleveland this year, definitely look me up. And if you're interested in VFC, let Darren know. I'd love to have you.
Well, very cool. Jeff, we appreciate you sharing these stories, the information you have, helping to preserve the football history and helping us celebrate this New York Giants 100th season as well. And we can't thank you enough and appreciate your time.
Thank you. Happy birthday, Giants fans. It's a great, great accomplishment, 100 years.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude. And I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know that. Can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you got to do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you got to do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.